voluminous and eventually how expensive. But if this is something that I'm going to be doing frequently, I'm willing to make the investment. Could I bring two of those panels or three of those panels with me? Would there be much of a packing problem of putting that much volume in my gear that I carry on a ferry to go to Martha's Vineyard? Since it folds up, when it's folded up, how big is it? And could you carry more than one of them? Over to you, Mel.
A2KEY, it's 2 foot by 2 foot folded. And they unfold like in a hinge, so that it opens up to four panels. In other words, when it closes up, the two outer panels are finished very nicely. It looks like a suitcase. And it winds up at about, I'm just judging when I saw it that one time, maybe about 2 inches thick. So, and how much did it weigh? Not much. I'd say maybe it weighed 5 pounds, maybe a little bit more. It's all plastic, of course, and all the material. It's not a heavy material, I guess. I guess you could carry it. Listen, you take the ex-wife along, and she carries one. So you got two of them. And you take the kids along, and they carry it. But, of course, you got a picnic basket, and things like that also have to go, so that could be a problem. But listen, I guess there's no end. If you have enough manpower going along, group going along, and everybody carries one and parallel them up, I guess you can have plenty of power, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I see I missed something. You told me 2 foot by two, and I thought that was folded out. That's the shipping dimension. And if it folds from each side, it sounds to me like it's going to become 2 foot by 4 foot or so when it's all folded out. That doubles the area, and therefore my 3 ampere estimate is going to be a 6 ampere estimate. And you said you got 5 and a fraction amperes. That's coming out right. Very nice. Okay. Solar is kind of practical. I've often wished that in the summertime, the parking lots of some of these big companies, which have got a huge chunk of macadam, which runs hot as all hell, and the most valuable parking spot is the one that's under a tree, so your car doesn't cook all day long. And it's not super hot when you get into it at night. It sure would be nice to have a bunch of solar panels above each parking spot, shading your car and collecting solar energy. Whether it's charging a car battery because you've got an electric car, or just generating electricity to run the building, to run the factory, that would be a win-win situation if you're willing to make the investment. I'd like to believe that at the end of our the greening of America, that we're going to start doing some things like that. Over to you, Mel, KQRIW.
The only experience I have with solar heating is next door. They have a pool. They have an in-ground pool they put in, and they put solar panels up on a roof to warm the water in the pool for the summer. And I was looking at the gauge on it, had it set, there's a regulator on there, and we took the water temperature in the pool. Now, this is a pretty big pool. The pool width length is about 25 feet, and the width is about, 12 feet at least, maybe 15, yeah, 15, I think it's close to 15 feet, and it's about, and the pool at its deepest is about 6 feet, no, it's 8 feet, 8 feet. I'm trying to picture of, exactly when I swim in it. And the pool water in there, just from solar heating, that's the only thing it heats that pool, and a little circulating pump, have the regulator set and maintain 91 degrees was exactly the measured temperature I was looking at in the pool tank, and just with solar panels, over.
And during that period of time, you saw the 90 degrees of the water. What do you believe was the average air temperature during that last week or so, Mel? Is he getting like, if the average temperature during that summer was 75 degrees, is he getting 15 or 20 degrees of solar heating of all of those thousands of gallons of water?
The pools open, start opening the pool in May, and the water will be warm enough to be comfortable within a few days by just the solar heating system. It'll get that pool water up there to 85, 90 degrees within approximately 3 days, when the temperature, the air temperature outside, you know, in May gets up there, I guess we start getting into around 70 degrees thick. But in the summertime, that pool stays nice and comfortable. It's amazing. Oh, you could get it up higher. I mean, you don't realize how much that temperature of that water could be raised to. I think you'd be scalding water in that pool if you really ever open that valve, that regulator valve wide, Dick, over.
So he's got a regulator system that either slows down or turns off the pump and shoots for 90 degrees and doesn't let it go above that. Is that what you're saying?
Actually cuts down the amount of flow, yeah, of the system. It's constantly pumping the water because it's going through this filter system that keeps the water nice and clean. So, and it's got these jets and all. It's got this built-in whirlpool jet. It's quite an elaborate thing. You see at night the way it lights up. It's gorgeous. All different colors displayed. It lights below the water level. So if you want to get a nice night in the summertime, it's 90 degrees out. Well, you can jump in the pool and cool off. It's a lot of fun, to tell you the truth. Over.
2 hours up. Go ahead, Frank.
Mel, I have a friend in Malvern who many years ago when he installed his above ground pool decided that it was too cold and he couldn't afford solar heaters, so he created his own poor man's heater. He purchased approximately 100 feet of black rubber hose, regular garden hose, and wound it in concentric loop on the roof of his garage. I'm not sure how he secured it to the garage, but he connected one end to the output of the filter and the other end back to the pool. And just like your neighbor with the expensive solar heater, within 2 or 3 days he had 90 degree water in his pool. How's that for cost savings?
What's your guess, Frank, as to the total number of feet of coiled up hose he had on that roof? And if there's a whole lot of feet of it, unless it's a pretty large diameter hose, you can build up quite a bit of back pressure trying to pump water through that much length of hose. Go ahead.
I know he started off with a 100-foot length. Given the fact that the garage was a good 10 or 15 feet behind the pool, he needed a substantial amount to go in and out. I'm not really sure how much he put on the roof of his garage. I believe he just kept winding until he had no more room. Then he brought the end down and almost instantly hot water, or very warm water, started coming out. Again, I'm not sure whether he used his existing pump or had to hook up an auxiliary one. I don't know all the facts, unfortunately, but in any event, I'm sure what he paid for the parts was a lot less than the commercial solar heater in 2 hours.
I believe that. And if he started off with a 100-foot hose and when he wants to add a second one because he wants to make more hot water, a total of 200 feet of hose, it doesn't have to be all in series. At the beginning of the pair of hoses, you could have a T-connector so that they're running in parallel. And at the output end, a T-connector. So he can make a modular system if he's got enough area of the roof of the garage where he keeps adding 100-foot hoses and just makes a more elaborate T-section going in and out of it. And you wouldn't... you wouldn't be building up back pressure. You would actually be lowering the back pressure as you add more hoses. You'd be pumping a little bit more volume of water, but not building up more pressure. A parallel series circuit, so to speak. If we do it with resistors, I guarantee we can do it with hoses. What do you think, Frank?
Sounds good to me. And given the fact that he had a pretty good pitch on his roof, gravity must have played a substantial role in getting that water back down into the pool, and the suction helped the pump bring it back up. So it's a win-win situation.
Well, the density of the water changes a little bit versus temperature. He's taking cooler water up to the roof and sending hotter water back down. He's got a pump against that differential, but it's not a really big pump. But this is all calculatable. You know roughly how much power you're getting out of the sun on a good day. You know how much area of hose you've got. So how many watts of heating you're going to get when those watts are turned into BTUs, and those BTUs are going to heat, let me pick a number, 5,000 gallons of water. How fast is it going to get hotter? That's all calculatable. It's the nice thing about physics and math. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW. I'm not sure if someone was making a comment. Want to give it a try? That I didn't get it because it was quite noisy.
Remember thermodynamic courses?
Okay. The thermodynamic courses that we took at Pratt sure do. All calculatable. Back to you, Mel.
Just remember, like I say, I was just going to say that. Remember the calculations, how to come back to me a little bit of that. Just the final words on it, then we'll get to the thing I got here with a lot of questions I've gotten this week on vertical antennas. I would like to get to a little discussion on it because I don't know how to answer the couple of questions that I got here. It's a black material that you take with you if you're going camping or whatever. You fill it with water, and you let it sit in the sun, and the water inside this thing, this rubber thing, gets hot, gets warm enough so you can get yourself a remote location, get yourself a warm shower stick. They got a regular shower thing that's on there with a flexible hose. The whole thing folds up very neatly, and like I say, you get to your location, you hang it up like on a side of something, on a tree or a post, and you fill it with water, and a few hours later you can have yourself a warm shower. That's another gadget. Oh, they got such things, I know, for camping and all. I always look through the magazine and everything I get, the company that sells it out, Outbacker and all. Should we take this question, and here maybe you can answer this question on vertical, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think you should go to the vertical question, Mel.
Okay, last week we had that quite a discussion about the elevated feed verticals. And they did have quite a, you know, a discussion in one of the mag in the ham radio and in QST, which I looked up, and I did read over quite a bit, but I don't understand, and a couple other people have made the same comment. What in the heck, and how do you go about calculating what is a zigzag matching network, and how do you calculate it? In other words, if I wanted to try to make one of these gap-type antennas, so, you know, that split in the middle, that's why I guess they call it gap, but of course, the guy who invented it in England, he actually came up with the original concept. But how do they determine, how do you determine what's a zigzag match, Dick? Do you have any idea, over?
No, I don't. I made some speculations last week that the length of the semiconductor that goes above the center insulator of the elevated feed antenna, where right at that insulator, the coax cable that comes in from the bottom, the shield connects to the top of the bottom section just below the insulator, and the semiconductor doesn't directly connect at that location. It goes up the center pipe and connects at the top of the center pipe. This is part of the broadbanding technique that makes it work on multiple bands. I have the impression that whatever the length of the upper pipe is, they wanted the semiconductor to be longer than that. That's the unshielded portion of the semiconductor of the coax cable. So spiraling it, zigzagging it, whatever, it isn't too difficult to calculate what impedance you'll have with that semiconductor with the polyethylene insulation on it, spaced some specific distance from the wall of the upper pipe. You can calculate what impedance that is. Knowing what length it is, you can figure out what phase delay it's going to give you and how it's going to act like a stub. So it's a slightly different Z0 cable, higher in impedance than 50 ohms, of a longer length than the upper pipe. This is my speculation. And you could analyze that. You could figure out what its impedance is and what its electrical length is and what effect it has on the way it feeds that upper pipe. That is not easy, but calculatable. That's my guess. Of all the balloning-like devices I've seen, I don't remember seeing one called the zigzag balun or the zigzag impedance matcher. That sounds like a coined set of words that represents the way that particular thing was done. I can't remember the guy's name that wrote this original elevated feed antenna article, but the more I hear about that antenna, the more I like it. Over to you, Mel, KQRIW.
Roger, yeah, that was John or Jack, VE3CV, that wrote the article when he did analysis of it, and he's the one that said the only way to describe it is a zigzag type of match, and he says, I don't really understand really also basically what is how it really works. He says he couldn't really pin down the actual operation of the antenna. And it's like stuffed in. I looked at it. I mean, I saw it. It's like stuffed into the pipe. How you could possibly make any kind of a specific arrangement into I guess the pipe looks like about an inch and a half piece of aluminum pipe. How the heck you can make any specific arrangement other than maybe push the wire in, let it come out the top, push it back down and up, you know, you couldn't basically, how could you really control much of, you know, how it winds around inside of the pipe dig, inside the pipe? That's why I think he referred to it as basically a zigzag in the pipe. He says that's the only way he could come up with. In fact, he made a little sketch of what he thinks was in there, how it looks, and it just looks like there's a piece of the wire, that center portion of the coax, just going up and down in some way, Dick, over.
I've got another guess, Mel, as to how this antenna could have come about. I have, me and the guys I work with, have often run into a situation where you're trying to impedance match a particular antenna across a frequency region. And with pencil and paper, you draw yourself some diagrams, and you look up some charts and graphs, and you make some guesses. And then you start making some measurements when you fabricate the real antenna. But once the real antenna is in front of you, and long you've got reasonable instrumentation, a good vector network analyzer, we'll say, or a signal generator and a spectrum analyzer and directional couplers, but you've got some kind of instrumentation where you can measure how well the antenna is behaving standing wave ratio-wise. And you say, what will happen if I make this piece of unshielded coax cable that's going up the center pipe, if I make it a little bit longer? I solder on another piece and stuff it in there. And you make another measurement. And you find out, gee, it's getting better. Let's keep doing it. There's a number of situations where you try something as sort of a random experiment. You start hitting some pay dirt, and you keep doing it. And you come up with an antenna. I've come up with a couple of patentable antennas with that technique, where had I studied the problem thoroughly in a theoretical manner, I never would have come up with that antenna. But once you're in the lab and you're a little bit desperate and you start trying things, serendipity strikes. Maybe only one quarter of the experiments you try are an improvement, but that's good enough. If you've got enough perspicacity, enough perseverance to keep trying experiments, and only one quarter of them are an improvement, and you keep doing it, you're going to get there. Over to you, Mel, KQRIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY, so in other words, we really can't tell you how to duplicate the experiment exactly. If you took two pieces of pipe, and approximate length, you know, it's split in the middle. They tell you basically the total height of the antenna. And you split it in the middle, but to try to make some kind of a setup like that, I guess, get enough wire and keep cutting and playing around, you'll find something out. But I can't tell you there's a formula, or I've never seen anything in any of the antenna manuals that have ever described any kind of situation like that. I can tell you, they cause an elevated, you know, feed, and so I am, you know, guess a little bit in the dark as to really how you would really do anything to determine if you wanted to, you know, model it or whatever. I don't think there's anything I can tell you offhand about that I can think of, Dick, over.
Let me ask you this, Mel. Have you seen the original ham radio article on the elevated feed antenna? I may have it somewhere in the house, but I'm going to have to find that issue of ham radio. As a ARRL life member, I can look at all the archives, and the archives will allow you to look at past issues of QST. Unfortunately, they have not yet archived ham radio. So we're going to have to go back to the original issues or go to some other website that shows you past issues of ham radio. But if we go back to the original VE6CV, is it the article, in ham radio, I wonder if he mentioned the so-called zigzag impedance match to that upper section and the way it broadbanded things so it works on multiple bands. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
If I could run and get it, take me 2 minutes. I could grab it out of the file. I have it handy. I did pull it out. I printed it up in the file. And it's Jack Belrose, VE3CV, who did it and did the review and all. And he actually did say, I don't quite know how to explain it 100%. He was, and he is a fairly sharp guy. He's written quite a number of articles, you know, on antenna systems over the years for the magazine. He's experimented quite a bit with different abstract antennas that really were, you know, some of the most wildest designs. He's, you know, been able to duplicate them and actually give a review. So if you like, I could just grab it. Take me about 2 minutes, over.
You've already said the magic words, Mel, and that is, don't be discouraged. These are my comments now. Don't be discouraged by the fact the guy says, I can't completely explain how it works. I've been there a number of times. You try various experiments. You lengthen the lead here. You add a capacitor there. You add a stub here. There are times when you come up with various combinations when you're doing the physical experiment, just trying things to try to make it work better, and it starts working better. And the theory behind it could be pretty hairy, but as long as what you're doing is repeatable, you can measure that, I put an extra 6 inches of cable and I stuff it down this this pipe. And you may discover, much to your surprise, that whether you stuff it by waving it back and forth between the top and the bottom of the pipe, or just spiral it in there, it may not make any difference. As long as the extra length is in the shielded upper structure, you get the benefit you're looking for. It may be one of these situations where you think it's supercritical, that each serial number has to be laid out exactly the same way. And sometimes Mother Nature is very pleasant. Sometimes, as long as you got the right length of cable stuffed in there, it'll do the thing you're looking for. Give you the right phase delay at the right impedance, and it's close enough. And that tiny little bit of difference from serial number to serial number, you had a small trimmer capacitor here and there, and you're there. One or two of the antennas I've worked on that are working extremely well, I'm having a fair amount of difficulty explaining why it works so well. I'm not talking about super high gain. I'm talking about super low standing wave ratio across a very wide bandwidth. I'm having some trouble explaining why the standing wave ratio is so low over such a wide bandwidth. And as I've mentioned to you once before, one of those antennas will not respond correctly to the computer modeling. But we've now built 15 of those antennas, I have with my own hands, for various experiments, built 15 of them, and they all do this super low noise, super low standing wave ratio, which is required for a particular requirement. So I'm not discouraged when the guy says, I don't know how, but it works. Do it this way, and it'll work. That's not scary. Research is like that sometimes.
Repeater, timeout.
Research is like that sometimes, Mel. Back to you, K2LIW.
I pulled it out of QST. I pulled the article here. I could say it was in QST. It was reviewed. There were two reviews that were done on this antenna. One was by Bill Kennemer, K5FUV, who used to write quite a bit. This was in, it's in the January 1995 QST, January 1995, and then it was reviewed by Jack Belrose, or John, or Jack, he calls himself either or, and that's also in the January, and it is under technical correspondence, and he reviews a vertical monopole with elevated feet or a full-length radiator. And they go into, well, he goes into a lot of very interesting concepts on antenna design deck that he also did modeling using the NEC-2 program at the time, which I used, the Mini-NEC, and how he was able to come up with some answers. But it also has a thing called Exploring RF. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, I read the section last week in the second correspondence where Jack Belrose was talking about the fact that his antenna had now turned into a number of commercial products that were making some pretty strong claims, and he was telling you which of the claims he didn't support. But his original article is in Ham Radio, and that could be very interesting, and I haven't seen that one yet, Mel, go ahead. And by the way, I think that was back in the 80s is when he wrote his original article.
That was the other article. I saw that. I don't have that in front of me now. That's in the was in the Ham Radio. But here, the one he has here in January 1995, when he reviews this antenna that it came on the market, and he says that the stuff is contained within the upper section by zigzagging inside the tubing, and he's got a sketch of it there, and I don't quite understand it really. The zigzagging. Is it random zigzagging? Is it some way that they made up a special piece of cable or what? But he says, I assume that there's something more complex going on here, because I see the precise details of how this antenna functions on the all band is not clear to me. And so that's the thing. And then he goes into what he thinks it's doing, but he's not sure, Dick. But that's what he says. He finishes it with that. However, that the precise details, how does that antenna function, I do not know. Over.
Now, in the section you're now reading, Mel, is he only describing the zigzag in words? Has he given you a diagram of the way it looks inside the pipe? I think he has not. But maybe in the original Ham Radio article back in the February, back in the 80s, he may have described the way you do the zigzagging inside the pipe. Back to you on that one.
He's got a little diagram here right next to it. If you could bring it up, January 1995 QST. This was his next article. He did a series of articles for Ham Radio, but he went a little further with this article because the other, the Ham Radio, he just was using the original concept from the guy who designed it. In the UK, this station, what the heck was his name? The G3. Let me see if I can find that. Who was the originator of it? I don't know where it is. I have it here someplace also. But when he reviewed it, this is the last review he did on this antenna. He's even sketched out a little article and goes band from band how he thinks it's working on the band for band operation, Dick. But he said the precise details of how it functions. He says, "I'm sure I'm not really understanding." So this is, and then he did a complete analysis of how his experiment with vertical monopole with elevated feet take over.
Okay, I found the article, Jan 1995 QST. Page 78. Is that the one we're talking about?
The one he did the technical correspondence on a vertical monopole with elevated feet. The page before... Oops, sorry. The page 77. Page 77 shows his article on how does it work. That's another one of his articles. He follows it up on the next page with that technical correspondence. but on the page 77, he's got a sketch of what he thinks is going on over.
Okay, I'm looking at page 77 right now. And, I see the zigzag. Is that what I'm looking at? When I look at the diagram on the bottom of page 78, am I looking at a zigzag? No, that's a tower section. Okay. Page 77 is where he begins his technical correspondence. Do I have to go back to page 76, Mel?
No, because on the previous page, they just described the antenna, you know, as the manufacturer describes it. But on 77, that sidebar that over there by Jack Belrose is basically the technical, you know, where he actually, looked into actually how it's constructed. And this is the sketch and all of what he thinks is going on, over.
Okay, I'm a little bit confused here. January 1995, I'm on page 77, and I'm looking for a sidebar about Belrose. Okay, it's not a sidebar. Belrose wrote the thing in technical correspondence called a vertical monopole with elevated feed, full-length radiator, by John S. Jack Belrose, VE2CV. And I think he's going to describe things in words, and the diagrams he gives and the antenna patterns down below. I don't think there's a diagram of the zigzag, although he does show the balloning structure that feeds a tower that I think is used. The figure 2 design. Which diagram should I look at if there is a diagram, Mel? Go ahead.
The antenna that we're discussing, the one he did, that's his experiment when he did it with tower sections, elevated feet. On 77 is a how does it work? There's a sidebar in there. It says how does it work? It's like framed off that section. This is, let me see, what is that? Drawings courtesy of, oh, the actual description here, as far as it was actually described, was in Radio Communications. The Review in Radio Communications, December 1991 issue of Radio Communications by Peter Hart. Ah, there's the guy, G3SJX. That's the guy who designed this thing originally, Dick, over.
Okay, I'm having a problem here. I'm looking at page... Stand by a second. I'm looking at page 77, QST Archives. Starts off the technical correspondence, Jan 1995, and on page 77 itself, I don't see a sidebar labeled, how does it work? I don't see a sidebar with that label. You're looking at the real magazine, and I'm looking at an archive of it. Is it possible they didn't photograph the whole page? Go ahead.
I guess so, because I got the original page here. And when I found out where it was, I have to have that. I tore out, you know, I did it. So they don't have a mountain of magazines back to the ceiling here. I take out all the featured articles and throw away all the advertising and all that stuff and all, so I can reduce 100 magazines down to the thickness of maybe an inch rather than, you know, a few feet high. That's what I do, so... I have all these articles, like I say, going way back, and I was able to dig up the original article, Dick, over.
Yeah, I see now that as I look at this archive, and I look at page 77, it has the wrong height from top to bottom. So something is missing vertically. But you're describing something that's horizontal. I'm looking at what looks like the total page width. The left-hand side of the page at the top starts off with the title Technical Correspondence. The right-hand side of the page on the upper right-hand corner says Conducted by Paul Pagel, N1FB. Is there more width than those two things that I just described on the top of page 77?
Boy, completely different from what I have. My page 77, like I say, the original issue from QST, was reviewed by Bill Kenema. 77 starts out on the top. The first word is R7. One afternoon, I ran across the New Zealand station. That's what it starts out at the top. And it's vertical, complete narrow, about 3 inches wide, you know, whole dissertation. On the right of that, on that page, is a framed-off area, complete framed-off area, about 4 inches wide, and the full length of the page, which says, how does it work, Dick? Over.
So you're telling me the top of page 77 doesn't begin with the word technical correspondence. Technical correspondence and the two horizontal bars that surround that section is down further from the top of the page. Is that what you're saying?
No, the technical correspondence starts on page 78 here. The publisher's there. Technical correspondence conducted by Paul Pagel, N1FB, associate technical editor. That starts on page 78 here, Dick. Over.
Okay, in the archives, that's on page 77. The very bottom of page 78 has got some antenna diagrams, and it shows a tower feeding system. And I don't see the top of page 78, and I guess I'm not really seeing the bottom of page 77. There's something missing in there. Oh, well.
Roger, that's missing. That's right. It's not exactly the exact copy of the magazine as it was originally printed. But okay, anyhow, he shows this thing that's zigzagging and all. How does it work? And he says it's really a good question. How does this type of antenna achieve a match on various bands? Several antenna experts referred me to review it, but I can't really come up with an answer. It originally was described by Peter Hart, G3SJX, in December 1991 issue of Radio Communications. And here's a summary of what Peter has to say, and then he gives the information that he thinks about it, Dick. But they go into a lot of information about how the antenna is constructed and all. Radio Communications Magazine, is that available anywhere? Over.
RADCOM, as the Brits call it, is their official journal of the... We have the American Radio Relay League, and we print QST. They have the Radio Society of Great Britain, RSGB, and it prints a monthly journal called RADCOM, Radio Communication. So is that available? Yeah, you can easily get a subscription to it, and are there archives you and I have available to us? There, I don't know. Now, you're seeing the side there. You're seeing Mr. Belrose's diagram. Can you describe what it looks like? Does it look like the wire... the extra length of wire that's in that upper aluminum tube, is it literally put into a Z-fold before being slipped inside? Try to describe the diagram that you see, Mel, go ahead.
I'll tell you what. See if you can Google G3, George 3, Sugar Juliet X-ray, G3SJX, Peter Hart, and see, he does... A lot of radio communications, I think, did a lot of the technical correspondence also. He's the one that came up with this contraption. I don't know if you could find much on him. Maybe refer to some of his writings. But it's George 3, Sierra Juliet X-ray, Peter Hart. Now, how he describes it, I can say the feeder comes in right at the bottom of the pipe, approximately 16, it's 25 feet, somewhere about split in half, this 25 foot length of pipe. As you described it, the coax comes in through the bottom. It goes up to the place where it's split. At that point, the shield connects to the upper portion of the bottom section, the lower section, we'll call it the lower section. The shield connects to that, to the casing. This the pipe is insulated from ground. There are a bunch of these little pieces of PVC pipe that act as a standoff, you know, around the pipe for the clamps to be insulated from the supporting structure, so that the lower section is not connected to ground. Let me let it drop.
by the way,
center of the coax, continuing on, now goes through the split in the middle called the gap or the insulating sleeve. It continues up the upper section, and it says there, cable folded inside tube. The cable is folded inside the tube a number of times, and then winds up that center, winds up coming back up at the top, where it's terminated at that point from a here. They get the here, he measured the capacitance at 2,440 picofarad, 2,440 picofarad from that center that's been folded inside that pipe, now goes through that capacitor to ground. In other words, the capacitor one side is grounded. I looked at that capacitor. It looked like one of old-fashioned barrel capacitors that they use in TV sets. And one side goes to the pipe. The other side goes to that centerpiece of coax. And that is basically how it is fed. Then they have these rods that stick outside, these so-called tuning rods, that different lengths. They call them tuning rods. They act as capacity loading as far as he's concerned. They go.
I found on Google a whole lot of articles by G3SJX, but I haven't found any of them yet relevant to an elevated feed antenna. What other key words should I use other than G3SJX? What other words should I use to get to the article that you're referring to, Mel?
The Peter Haas article is the, his antenna. He calls it the DX, Dog X-Ray, dash VI. That's what he calls it. I guess it maybe it sounds, maybe it's VI, means six, but he's got the letters DX dash and a V and an I, Dick. That's exactly, it looks like it would be like a Roman numeral for VI, maybe six, but I think the way it's printed here, it's DX-VI by Peter Haas, G3SJX, December 1991 of radio communications. His description of how he made this thing, over.
Sorry for the interruption. I'm Googling DXVI right now. I'll be with you in a minute.
DX dash. Maybe. It's a dash between the DX dash VI by Peter Haas, G3SJX. That's exactly the way it's showed here, Dick.
There's something here called Whittier Vertical Antenna Design. Donald Newcomb, that can't be it.
Just a reminder, Dick, it's 5 minutes to midnight in 2 hours, so.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. Yeah, we're running out of time pretty fast.
Everybody next week. Thank you for your support here and good wishes and from many of the pieces of mail. A lot of good stuff. 73, this is KTKEY.
39 mil. This was check that number. Huh. I'm hearing myself being fed back. Check that number 1,238 of the series that began way back in 1982. We'll be back next week, and we'll look a little bit further into this elevated feed vertical antenna. Looks like an exciting subject. Bye-bye, you all, and see you later. K2RW clear. Be kind to each other. Gee, I'm not being repeated now. Bye-bye, you all.
Catch you next week. Yeah, if you get a chance, look in a little deeper, because there's something going on here that we have never really looked into or seen. Very fascinating. Maybe try to some experiments with some of this elevated feed and see if some of these claims are true. All right. Talk about next week. 73. Good night.
Good night, Mel.
Look into gap and
my question, K2RAW.
Yeah, answer exodus. I was just about to ask a question before the answer I came in. Like, anyway, I'm trying to buy a gap antenna. Look at gap challenge, the X. Maybe in principle what you guys are talking about.
W, W2OAY, are you still tuned in over here?
Over here. I think I am, Joe. Go ahead.
My question, and I've been waiting for a long time for this one, when are you going to discuss the Bessel function?
Oh, boy, that one's heavy. What specifically do you want to know about that one, Joe?
I was just waiting to hear it as a complete subject within itself. You said you were going to discuss that many, 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 many months ago. Either you or Andy or somebody like that was going to discuss it. And I was just kind of waiting for the subject to be brought up, so I thought I'd remind you.
Okay, it's a good subject. Other than the word bezel, what do you want to know about it?
Okay. I know you can use it to calibrate equipment that requires knowing what your deviation is depending on what the nulls are, what you see in the spectrometer. If you have a generator putting out a certain audio tone at a certain level, will give you nulls at certain distances away from, I guess, distances at the center frequency that you're looking at, correct?
Yes. There are certain modulation indices which will create nulls of either the carrier, the first sideband, the second side lobe, yeah, first side lobe, second side lobe, and so on. And so, you want an explanation for why those nulls occur?
Not specifically. I think I have an idea how that works. But if I heard the whole discussion, it would be better. But I was told by someone that, say, for example, if you modulate a 1,000 hertz signal at 2.45 kilohertz, you'll get an exact null at the center of the carrier. And I mean, using that like for reference for measurements purposes. Do you think that's about correct?
Absolutely. You could say what's happening as you're doing angular modulation is that at the carrier frequency, your FM modulation or phase modulation, whichever you want to call it, is spending half of its time in phase, half of its time out of phase, at the carrier frequency, and that's one way of explaining why the carrier gets nulled out. In the case of amplitude modulation, you are supplying extra power from the modulator, and that's the power that goes into the side lobes. In the case of angular modulation, the amount of carrier power, the total amount of power coming out of the transmitter, never changes. What you are changing, though, is how far you and wide you smear that power. And so at certain angular modulation rates and magnitudes, certain things get phased out, and the carrier is one of them. Since there's an exact chunk of mathematics that tells you when you mail out that carrier. The
reflector 9126 link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
Tells me the generator is working correctly. It's running the right deviation outputs, telling me so. And the receiving apparatus receiving that is receiving the right information also at a very small percentage of accuracy.
Okay. There is this parameter that they use in the angular modulation world called modulation index. Modulation index is defined as delta F over F sub M. Delta F means how much you're deviating up and down. F sub M is the rate at which you're doing it. If the delta F of F sub M comes out to be 2.455, which you know the number we're talking about, that is the magic modulation index that gives you that null. If I change the F sub M, the 1 KC rate, to 900 hertz, I'm taking the same amount of deviation when I calculate the modulation index, and I'm dividing by a different number. Therefore, I won't get 2.45 anymore. That's one simplistic explanation for why changing the rate doesn't give you the null. I think, though, from what you're saying, you want to dig a little bit deeper and know why does that particular modulation index create a null? KQLIW.
Well, that certainly would be nice to know, because I know if you go to 2 KC, you'd have to increase your deviation by just about doubling it to get the same effect as far as seeing the null. So you can actually calibrate this on a wider deviation. You have to increase your audio tone level accordingly.
You said approximately double. It's exactly double. So if you're doing it at a 2 KC rate instead of a 1 KC rate, your amount of deviation must be exactly doubled. Now, part of what's going on is that one definition of frequency is the rate of change of phase of the signal you're transmitting. That's what frequency is. I go through 360 degrees of phase in 1 microsecond if my transmitter is running at 1 megacycle. FM modulation means that your instantaneous frequency is going higher and lower. When your instantaneous frequency goes higher, the upper portion of your FM deviation, during that period of time, your rate of shifting in phase, so to speak, the 360 degrees of one sine wave, is happening more rapidly. You have to accumulate a certain amount of phase on the upper half of the sine wave of the modulation, and the same thing on the lower half, in order for the FM to work right. If my FM rate is 2 KC instead of 1 KC, I'm spending a shorter period of time on the upper half of that sine wave of the modulation, the original audio, so to speak. Therefore, I don't get a chance to accumulate the same amount of phase shift unless I deviate twice as far in frequency. Does that help a little bit? Go ahead.
It sounds like it's a linear formula. If you're 1 KC at 2.45, if you go to 2 KC, your deviation level would be exactly double, and so forth. So it's actually, that's a ratio. So if I knew a certain tone frequency I had, I could know that if I increase that deviation to a certain level of deviation, I would get a null at a certain deviation level, knowing the tone frequency also.
Give that man a cigar. You've got it. The thing you're keeping constant as far as the first null of the carrier is concerned is that 2.45 modulation index. And modulation index is delta F over F sub M. So if you didn't want to set your deviation to plus or minus 2.45 KC, you wanted it to be 3.01 KC. Knowing that you want the modulation index to be 2.45, you could calculate the new frequency of modulation that will do that. Instead of 1 KC, maybe it's 1.75 KC. So once you understand the principle, you can choose the modulation rate that will give you the exact amount of FM deviation that you think you want, and it will create that carrier null that you can see on a spectrum analyzer, and it doesn't depend on the accuracy of your frequency discriminator that's making the measurement. It's an exact measurement of spectrum generated by a angular modulated wave. By the way, this works on either phase modulation or frequency modulation, which is crazy. As long as you're not changing the frequency that you're sending through the microphone, so to speak, FM and phase are almost identical. There's a slight, subtle difference between them, but modulation index for an FM modulation and modulation index for a phase modulation has the exact same definition. Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
Okay, well, I was able to self-calibrate the FM generating portion of my service monitor, or at least check the accuracy of it on the different modes that it measures, going up to about 60 kilohertz, I believe, the top range of the instrument. So I was able to do that and get a reasonably good idea that the instrument is pretty much sending and receiving correctly like it's supposed to be, because I don't own an external deviation meter to be able to take my generator and put it into that and tell me what I'm actually sending. I had to more or less self-check myself with other test equipment that I have handy.
Okay, you said you checked the calibration up to 60 kilohertz. The 60 kilohertz was the amount of deviation, or the 60 kilohertz was the rate of modulation? You didn't say which.
I believe 60 kilohertz is the maximum deviation that the instrument will read full scale. That's the highest range.
Okay, but if you were therefore looking at a FM broadcast between 88 and 108 megs, which I think the channels are 200 KC wide, I think you're allowed to deviate plus or minus 75 kilohertz, you're telling me that your service monitor doesn't go there, and that makes sense, because it wasn't designed to check a broadcast 88 to 108 megacycle FM receiver. Go ahead.
That is absolutely correct. If I put it on an FM broadcast station, it will just about continuously pin the meter past 60 kilohertz deviation. I'm aware that the deviation on FM broadcast is plus or minus 75. But it does let me go to an analog TV station and see what their deviation is, which should be plus or minus 15.
Yeah, I think the absolute maximum they're allowed to use on television audio is plus or minus 25 kilohertz. Go ahead.
Oh, really? I thought that was 15, and I think that was 25. But okay, I stand corrected.
Yeah, they're allowed to go to plus or minus 25. They may not use it. They probably have limiting circuits and whatever, but I think that's the maximum they're allowed to use, just like FM broadcast is allowed to use plus or minus 75. And they've got to have nice rounded corners as they approach that plus or minus 75. They're not allowed to go beyond that, is my understanding.
Uh-huh, very good. Okay, good. That's, I had an idea on the thing, and you sort of clarified things. Of course, you're going into the, much deeper into the theory behind it, and, I'm slowly catching on with how the theory into this stuff works. I really don't have, as much of a background as you, nowhere near that you have in this kind of stuff. So I find it fascinating, and I try to, listen and learn.
Yep, it's an educational process. The mathematics that goes into Bessel functions, if you've ever seen it written out in equation form and integral form and whatever, it's pretty wild stuff. It was highly misunderstood when FM modulation was first proposed by, I think it was Armstrong, way back in the late 30s. Because they did some preliminary math, came to the conclusion that you don't just have one set of sidebands with FM. See, with AM modulation, you whistle into the mic at a 1 KC rate, you create an upper side lobe and a lower side lobe, sideband, 1 KC displaced on the carrier. In the case of FM, you create not one side lobe, but an infinite number of side lobes. Once they saw the mathematics of that, it scared them, and a bunch of smart people at the time predicted, that it couldn't work. It was unusable. And so there was a long time before, I think it was Armstrong, built his tower in Alpine, New Jersey, and actually went and proved it, that it did work. The mathematicians at the time were saying, you can't do this, to which Armstrong was saying, I'm doing it anyhow. Here it is, listen to it, and I'm broadcasting it. So there are an infinite number of side lobes with angular modulation. That's the bad news. The good news is that depending on what modulation index you're using, they fall off real fast. So if you've got the right kind of instrumentation, you can measure the 40th side lobe of a 1 kc modulation, 40 kc away, small deviation, but it's going to be super weak, and it doesn't really give you any adjacent channel power ratio problems. So once they realize that and refine the math a little bit more, they suddenly realize, hey, this works. Angular modulation is not a completely linear process, mathematically speaking, yet I can put some nice hi-fi music on an FM transmitter, and what comes out the other end of the receiver when you transmit it will sound like awful high fidelity. From that point of view, it's very linear. But you do have to do some funny things to experience extremely high linearity. You can't get extremely high linearity out of narrowband FM receiver. A wideband FM receiver, you can. There's a bunch of complicated reasons as to why that happens. Over to you, Joe.